Continuing education credits for physicians and other healthcare professionals is provided by VCU Healthcare Continuing Education. Check out cribsiders.vcuhealth.org for more information.
The Cribsiders podcast is for entertainment, education, and informational purposes only. The views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the host.
Welcome back to the Cribsiders.
What's up?
I'm Justin Burke, joined tonight by Dr. Chris the Chew Manchu, and our wonderful producer for today, Dr. Crystal Nora. Say hi, Crystal.
Hello.
So wonderful to have you. What a great guest. What a great show. Our guest tonight is Dr. Tom Pham. He is here to discuss the management of pediatric burns. But before we do that, hey, Chris, can you remind us about the show?
Sure. We are the Pediatric Medicine Podcast. We interview leading experts in the fields to bring you clinical pearls, practice-changing knowledge, and answer lingering questions about topics in pediatric medicine.
I am so excited for you all to hear our conversation with our guest, Dr. Tom Pham. He's a board-certified surgeon, director of the University of Washington Regional Burn Center, and a professor of surgery. His research interests include the impact of frailty on aging populations and improving access via telehealth. He teaches us about triaging burns, really great pearls about burn management, and I'm sure you'll extinguish any fears you have about caring for pediatric burns.
Extinguish fears. There's the pun. Hello, Dr. Tom Pham. We are so excited to have you for the show. Welcome to the Cribsiders.
Thank you very much. I'm equally excited, if not more excited, because it's my first time with you guys.
This is, yeah, there's just a lot of good energy in the room already. I love this. I'm very excited. I would love to get to know you a little bit better. I know our listeners would get to know you a little bit better. Can you give us an introduction, maybe describe yourself in a one-liner, or maybe tell us something about yourself outside of the field of medicine?
Yeah, I was reading your description and I couldn't pretend to be quite a podcaster. You know, this is only the third podcast I've ever done. So please pardon my naivete in this. I'm a general surgeon. I work in Seattle. I'm also a husband and a father, but only of two. I love to cook and I love Netflix. And what else do I do with my time? I'm trying to not work as much as 80 hours anymore.
Smart. I worked on that too.
Yeah, you are. You are. Yeah, it's been 20 some years, but I think I'm starting to catch on.
I love that.
I specialize in burn care. I was trained as a trauma and burn surgeon after some training in general surgery. So this is like what I love to talk about. So thank you for having me.
We're so excited to have you with the Netflix. Have you watched anything good recently? Any good show that you've been binging?
Well, I'm about a decade behind other people because, you know, I spent too many years trying to write papers and all the silly things. But now my wife and I, we watch Blacklist. And so that's
Throwback.
Yeah, yeah. That's our current binge. And we're on season two, you know, and we have a lot of hypotheses and stuff like that. So we compare notes and stuff like that. And usually my wife gets things faster than I can. So it usually works out that like she explains things to me and I gotta go, you know, so it works for our marriage.
Wait, is that James Spader? Is that who's in it?
Yeah, yeah. It's James Spader minus the hair that he used to have in the 1990s.
But he's great in everything, I swear. He's just such a wonderful actor.
He has a lot of talent, yeah. But I think, you know, that character is actually, I mean, the show, he's absolutely insufferable. Which then makes him great, you know, because like, you have to put up with his long explanation before he shoots somebody. And so that's the last thing I would want to experience is like to get a lecture before I die or something, you know?
Very fair. That's really funny. One thing that I found that I was looking into was that you actually trained for a little bit to be a firefighter. I saw a new segment of you trying to do some of the things that the firefighters do.
No, that's a fake. I think you might have found that on Google or something. It's not a fake. What it is that we do that, I hope now every year, and we kind of took a break in a pandemic. But what we do in our burn center is we have this firefighter for a day kind of event. And we encourage our staff to go spend the day with the firefighters. And they put on this whole thing about like, hey, you know, this is how you climb the ladder. And this is how you like, use the hose and all that stuff. And it's pretty much to tell our staff and ourselves like, hey, if you think your day is hard in a hospital, try to put yourself in the shoes of a firefighter. Mm. Because the truth is, and I mean that seriously, is that I've never been asked to like run into a burning building to rescue somebody I've never met. Okay. Like I can take care of burn patients and, like, you know, try to do the best I can, but nobody's ever asked me to risk my life doing that. And I try to remember that. And that's a very humbling experience to be with firefighters. And the partnership is natural, right? Like, you know, without them, we won't have any patients. So it's a really good way to kind of build bridges across the continuum of care, actually, with firefighters. So we have a great relationship. They sponsor a pediatric camp for us every year.
Oh, cool.
And it's like, it's this whole world that we've built, not us, me, myself, but, like, you know, that a whole burn community is exactly that. Like, you go to a burn meeting, you have, like, patients, survivors, firefighters, nurses, therapists, docs, of course. And so it's a big community, you know. I would never want you to outdrink a firefighter. That's one, something I recommend against. They're very, very strongly. It's a great friendship that we have.
That's amazing. Yeah, I love that.
So yeah, I think wherever you work, like, if you're interested in pediatric burns, you know, like, go check out that camp. It's an amazing thing. I go every year. I tend to be asked to be the judge. There's a pool contest where there's two events. There's a cannonball and the belly flop.
This is amazing.
Oh, diving contest.
So much.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh. Well, it's technically a splashability. Okay.
Okay. You have that's to, the criteria.
Yeah. Yeah, you have to splash the judges. But after, like, a couple of splashes, I pretty much just jump in the water and, like, start grading from the nice. Water, you know? I also tell them that, you know, I went to public school, you know, I'm not like a private school kind of kid. So I don't grade as well. As, like, you know, how come you didn't get a 10, you know? Yeah. And I said, well, you know, you had to try a little harder, like, you know.
Yeah, there's no grade inflation in public school.
Yeah, you have to splash me a little harder to get a higher grade, you know?
Hey, Cripsiders listeners, we're back with another sponsor. This is all about Freed. Freed is an AI scribe that listens, transcribes, and writes medical documentation for you. Freed was built for clinicians by their significant others. Gabby, a family med physician, and Erez, a computer engineer, are married. Erez built Freed so Gabby could stop charting over the weekends. It was one of those selfish presents that you secretly get for yourself. Freed is an AI scribe that does your medical documentation for you instantly. Freed listens, prepares your notes, and writes patient instructions. Charting is done before your patient even walks out of the room. Freed learns your style over time, just like any human scribe, and most importantly, it is HIPAA compliant. So you can try 10 notes for free, and after that, it only costs $99 per month. But better yet, Cripsiders listeners can get $50 off that first month. So try Freed for free right now by going to getfreed.ai. That's GETFREE.AI. And listeners of Cribsiders can use code CRIB50 for $50 off that first month.
Well, I am ready to take a deep dive into today's case, if that's cool with everyone. I'm learning from the best, y'all. All right. So it's an early morning at Cashlack Outpatient Clinic, and you are the triage clinician. You see a patient message from the family of Javier Gutierrez. He's a healthy 2-year-old child. Family writes that this morning, Javier accidentally knocked over his parents' hot coffee on his leg and has a burn injury. His family requests help in deciding if they should come in for your first appointment in your outpatient clinic or into the nearest ED. But before we discuss the triage of burns, can you help us better define what burns are and the classification system used for burns?
Yeah, I think I would imagine getting a call from Javier's parents, and that would be also in the burn clinic. And I'm sure for every call I get, you as pediatricians get, you know, 10 times the number of calls that are of similar nature. Burns are classified according to first, second, and third degree with corresponding physical characteristics. You know, the burn depth is something that we really care about because it's a function of the agent, the heat source, the duration of contact, and the skin thickness. So for, like, boiling water, like a case, in this case, a kid who had a coffee spill, you know, up to two-thirds of these wounds sometimes, especially if the coffee water is very hot, can be at least of a second degree, if not worse, you know. And second degree is something that is characteristically described as pink and moist on the more superficial type. Or sometimes it gets a little drier as you get deeper into the dermal injury. And then an injury that doesn't blanch, has a, what you call a eschar on top, is considered third degree. In contrast, the first degree burns are like the sunburns. You know, on those injuries, the skin is intact. It's just red. You know, I call a first degree burn a social disease, a second degree burn a medical disease, and a third degree burn a surgical disease. So a first degree burn is something that you get, like, when you're in Cabo San Lucas and you should have gotten more sunscreen. what you need to do is get out of the sun, go have maybe a couple of drinks, not for kids, but for adults, and then get out of the sun and be a little more cautious next time. But a second degree burn, you do need to seek healthcare. So I would tell Javier's parents to come in if they think that there's some blistering and that is a characteristic of second degree burn or worse. So second and third degree burn, you need to seek healthcare.
So we lost for a second, but so just so I can do some teach back, it sounds like the biggest triaging is really kind of looking at first, second, or third degree. First degree as a social disease, love that. So kind of superficial, nothing too worrisome. Second degree needing to at least be seen. That's if there's blistering or kind of pink, moist tissue. And third degree being when there's eschar or kind of a deeper, drier burn is how kind of the first big picture approach. Is that right?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. And this third degree burns in particular, they can look in multiple different ways. But I think one of the things to emphasize to the listeners is the what the skin does when you push on it. When you push on your skin and it blanches, what that means is that your dermis is alive. You can push away the blood from the dermal capillaries. And then when you let go with your finger, then you have that capillary refill, which is, you as pediatricians use that all the time when you're evaluating somebody with shock or whatnot. Well, dermal refill is a sign of dermal viability and enough perfusion. When you are sure that that happens, then that means like it's a good sign. You know, that's a second degree burn that has a good sign of healing. But when that's really slow, or you're not sure, or it actually doesn't happen at all, that's a bad sign. That the injury is going to potentially evolve and that the dermal injury is a very serious problem. So I think dermal viability by having that blanching test is an important thing. When I first got into this field, my teacher always told me to remind me of one thing is that, the kid will only let you do that once if you have a shallow burn. So that's something that also is a sign that, if it's painful, then that's also a good sign because your nerve endings are still alive.
So this whole episode really hits close to home because right before COVID, my eldest son, Primus, who some of the listeners may know, does the intro for the Cribsiders. He's the kid who does the read. He was in the school lunch line, and it was a grilled cheese and tomato soup day. And the kid next to him bumped into him and spilled the soup on his arm. And it was so hot, it caused blistering of his arm. And my wife had to go in, pick him up. And this is all like right at the beginning of COVID. So it was like a pain in the butt to get seen and all this other stuff. Could you tell us like, what are some of the first aid type things? Like what are the things that school nurse should have done or we should have done when we went to pick them up?
Well, the first thing is to remove the offending agent, right? So, get away from the source. The second thing, especially if it got onto your clothes, is to take that particular garment off. The next thing is as long as like the body surface area that's involved is not huge, just to try to cool the burn. So how do you cool the burn? There are a couple options. You can run tap water on, let's say, you hurt your hand in the kitchen, or in the case of your son, you go to the infirmary. Is that you run, was it the hand or the thigh?
It was his forearm, because he was holding his tray in it.
So you can put his forearm under the sink and run it under cool tap water for 20 minutes. The caveat of that is that while you do that you should also ask for healthcare access. You should not just do that and then kind of forego seeking care. That's the portion that worries us about these recommendations about cooling, is that we've all had splashes in our kitchen. If you haven't never heard of cooling, you've probably been living under the rock, or you never go in the kitchen. Either way it's fine, but if you cool and seek healthcare in a significant injury, I think that's the good combination. So at the infirmary, while your wife was driving in, your son should have put his forearm under cold water. Did that happen?
Actually, I don't know. I forgot to ask what exactly they did. I know by the time I got home, they had, they put some sort of ointment on it. They wrapped it up. And he had a scheduled appointment with his pediatrician the next day. So
I see. You don't have to go to medical school to like understand that like running your burn under cool water reduces pain. But what you may not realize is that the research now indicates that if you have like a dermal injury, it may limit the depth of your injury and keep that into that second degree medical burn as opposed to kind of turning more into the surgical burn. So it actually may limit the depth of injury, and that's been studied in Australia. So I think the data is like getting stronger and stronger that I think at least in the EMS system, you should think about cooling as long as you avoid things like hypothermia for patients. And so I would say a good thing to remember is something that you would do at home that next time you have something happen to you or your loved one.
And to follow up on that, it sounds like the cooling is really the thing that helps. And so, I mean, is equivalent like just having an ice pack, you know, put on the arm while you're going to the urgent care, or is there something specific about the running water? Is it anything that's cold, frozen peas?
We think that the ice pack is too cold. And so I think, you know, let's say you had to like travel and you couldn't travel with some water with you, or like, you know, you had a limited amount, I would put a cool washcloth on your forearm instead, as opposed to, you know, the peas you don't want to eat.
Got it. And so that's the Goldilocks temperature. It's just right. Not too hot, too cold.
Yeah. I've seen like people just like shove up ice, you know, against them. I mean, that's just too much, you know? So cool tap water is what you need. Why you call 911 or you call your parents or whatever.
And I think one of the things I think about with burns is often like the hot water that's spilling on someone or like the soup, but there are other burns that are out there as well too. Can you maybe talk about like maybe radiation burns or electrical burns or chemical burns that you may also encounter?
Yeah, let me just spend a couple minutes on scalds in the first place, because that's like really the most common injury cause. And, you know, I alluded to like the skin thickness, right? So like the younger the kid, the thinner the skin, so the more likely to have a deep injury. But scalds in particular are of like so many different types, because you have a 212 degrees when you have the boiling temperature. But then what has happened to that water that is now mixed in coffee? You know, the temperature has dropped significantly that you've had it on the counter. So at about 160 degrees Fahrenheit is when it takes you about 1 second to get a full thickness burn of exposure, you know? So that's something to remember. But what you talked about in your case, Chris, was the soup in the line. So soup and having fat in there is harder to get off, and it has a higher temperature when it's boiling and things like that. So when you hear about the injury type and what was in the liquid itself, so when you make pasta sauce or you make a stew, it's different than when you just have just boiling plain water. So that's something to kind of like think about. Now, the other types of burns are flame burns. So flame burns are especially in kids, is people getting into trouble from open cooking, especially in lower medical income countries. But also us in the U.S. is these kids doing things they're not supposed to. And so flame burns is the second most common. After that, you have contact with a hot surface. And then much more rare, especially because like safety is a lot better in our country now, is electrical injuries from the transmission of electricity through your body, or chemical injuries, because we tend to be a little bit safer in the way we store things. But they do occasionally happen, and those are the minority of injuries. But if you do some global health, and I'm sure that's of interest to the listeners as well, the incidence of injuries of electrical type, chemical type in areas of the world where like the regulations are not as advanced are much higher. And so, you know, I've been to places where like you have high voltage electrical injuries in the child, something that you see extremely rarely in the United States, for example.
I think that speaks to like some of the strengths that we have with like our counseling that we can do for our patients, thinking about like, sometimes I get in the routine of just saying, make sure that we have like safety plugs that are in the walls, but like really remembering that like there's serious injuries that kind of are on the other side if we aren't counseling patients around safety. And to go back to the Gutierrez family, we call them, we get some additional information, and we're trying to help decide where they're going to seek care. And there's a couple of options, it sounds like, for seeking care, which includes like an urgent care or maybe an acute care visit within the clinic versus whether or not someone should probably present to like an emergency department. What are the things that you use to help you decide or guide families as to maybe where they should be seen initially for the management of their burns?
Well, to be honest, you know, the way I work is I'm usually the second or third call, because then the patient is already at an urgent care, already at an emergency department. So I'm like the second or third line of defense on those. And I always remind that to our pediatricians who work with us in Seattle, Washington, is that they tend to see way more burns than I do. It's just that they tend to see burns of a less severe type. I think if the child and their parents want to be seen right away, an urgent care or an ED is fine. I think an ED is when you get to, like, it looks like it's going to be more than just a few spots on your arm, you know? That, like, an ED can help you manage, like, the overall systemic effect of a burn, as opposed to, like, hey, you know, I just got a splash and it's just my forearm, like in the case of Chris. So that's, I would say, the choice I would make as a parent, for example. Easy for me to say, you know, when our kids were young, we just barred our kids from coming into the kitchen, you know? And that's the thing that you can do because you can afford to. But, you know, another plug I want to put in into injuries is that injuries affect the most vulnerable ones. And so in families where, like, you have a lot of kids, you do a lot of things together in the kitchen, maybe big brother or big sister is watching a little brother or a little sister. That's when injuries happen. If you have a cooking pot on the ground because it's traditional to do that, or if you, like, let your child play with pots and pans, and now suddenly the pot or pan is on the stove, and then they try to reach for it and it actually now has some hot liquid in there. So that's a big deal, you know? So I want to say that, yeah, in my family, we bought our kids from going to the kitchen, but, like, in many families, that's not possible. So that's a major risk factor for injuries. And you can see that in the demographics of people who get injured in the pediatric population, you know, people with lower socioeconomic groups, immigrant communities, and parents who are very, very busy. So families with a lot of kids.
That's such an important point. And we try to integrate things like that into each show. And it's just a very a helpful thing to be reminded of, especially, I think there's stigma a lot of times of blaming parents when things like this happen, especially parent, like, internal stigma, you know, parents feeling very guilty, like they're a bad mother or a bad father because their child has a burn. And I think, you know, normalizing this, especially given children's proclivities, but also just the fact that there's a lot going on in a lot of families, that this is something that is important to always care for and bring compassion to. So I appreciate you bringing that up. It sounds like a couple of things that you mentioned as far as, again, kind of this triaging of where to go is depth of burn, but also you said, you know, the ED is better for places where there's not more than just a couple spots on the forearm. And so it sounds like the volume or the extent of the burn is a major factor in addressing the severity. Is that safe to say?
Oh, absolutely. Because, you know, the injury extent, we spend a lot of time on the depth. Now we can talk a little bit about what total body surface area burn means. But yeah, total body surface area burns, when you get to like 5%, it's much harder to, like, even deal with that, even at home. And that sometimes the urgent care can manage you, but then you have to kind of, like, have a plan for what happens with the next wound care and how you're going to manage at home. So that's when, like, people like myself come into place, because the injury is a little bit more extensive than something that you can schedule, like in Chris's son's case, like, to be seen by the pediatrician the next day.
So in the, you know, the ambulatory setting, like urgent care or seeing my son's pediatrician in the outpatient setting, like, what types of treatment options would we see? What's the management do we see? You know, if they have blisters, do they remove the blisters? Do they let it pop? Do we pop it? And do they pop it in the ambulatory setting? What type of dressings do you use? Do you just use Vaseline or do you use antibiotic ointment? These are sort of things that I've seen lots of different types of management.
Yeah. So when you have loose dead skin and some of them are still blistering, I think that if it's an area that's over 2 centimeters, which is our recommendation here locally in Washington, which is essentially the size of a quarter, you should remove it. And that's just a simple washcloth, and to remove that after some pre-medication on the child. These blisters that are larger, they tend to rupture anyway in the next day or two. And it just causes concerns for people who then otherwise, if they waited for it to rupture, they get a lot of consternation at home and they tend to kind of avoid using that extremity. And so it's not as useful to them, you know. I had a guy, this was an adult, not a child, but, like, he had a burn on his palm and he didn't seek care. He just let it be. And so, and he was in the operating room, but he came to me and, like, had his hands like this, like, you know, inside his shirt, like Napoleon, you know. And he's like, "Hey, Tom, come over here. Come over here. Come take a look at this." And then he shows me his hand. It's like a huge blister on his hand. I'm like, well, what have you been doing? He's like, well, I've just been kind of like, you know, protecting it. But then for like 5 days, he's been like living like Napoleon, you know? And you don't want to do that. You want to be able to just like, if you have a large enough blister, remove it, put a dressing on it, and then go on and use your hand. Don't have disuse, because if you have disuse, you tend to swell a lot more. It's not useful anyway. And if it pops at home, you're going to have to like think of plan B. And sometimes that you end up going back to the ER just for that. So I think a recommendation of any blister over 2 centimeters, or especially when it crosses a joint, the recommendation to remove is a pragmatic one. The exception to that is on little toddlers. So little toddlers who tend to cruise and they touch something hot and they have it on the tips of their fingers. I'm sure you guys have seen that. It's a very common presentation to pediatric care offices, is that when they're just on the tip of the fingers, it's often just easier just to put a needle through and deflate them, because fighting with a child to redress the tip of a finger for like a week is not beneficial to your mental health as a parent. and it's not good for them, because you put it on, they take it off, you put it on, they take it off. We've had parents like put a sock on it, it still doesn't quite work. So I think on the tip of the finger, the pragmatic thing is to deflate using a needle.
That's a really great practical tip. Now, so the other question I have is the use of ointments. So what ointments would you recommend? Should they be antibiotics infused ointments? Can they just be Vaseline? What type of dressing do you use? Do you Vaseline infuse dressings? Like what are your recommendations there?
So if you work through it backwards, Chris, and I don't want to do like a whole engineering lecture on what an ideal dressing is, but you want a dressing that stays on, and you want a dressing that slows the onset of infection. And you want a dressing that allows a moist wound healing so that it can regenerate. Given all those priorities, on average, for essentially a burn that recently blistered, and now you've removed the blister off, so you have a pink and moist base, a ointment such as a bacitracin, and on a gauze that you make greasy as a result of the bacitracin, you can add a little aquaphor to it, allows you to have that dressing provide an antibiotic environment, antiseptic environment, a moist wound environment, because that dressing, that greasy gauze, provides a hydrophobic barrier. And so when you have any efflux from the wound in terms of liquid, it traps it. And so it promotes a moist wound environment on the wound base for you to be able to heal more quickly. That's the average kind of like recommendation. Now, if you come to a more specialized center such as ours, and we have more advanced dressings, and we can get more fancy with those. On average, in a pediatric emergency care environment or in the doctor's office, a greasy gauze dressing with a topical antibiotic is a reasonable first start. For wounds that are more shallow, it's fine to use bacitracin, because it takes care of most of your gram-positive that may threaten your wound for a more shallow wound. As the wounds get deeper and deeper and the duration of healing is longer, you may think about something better than bacitracin, because you may need more gram-negative coverage in the next week or so.
And
so that's the framework.
Go
ahead. I'm sorry.
Nothing. Well, no, I think this is great, because I was going to say this is a great framework, and maybe it would be nice to go deeper. And two kind of follow-up questions would be, what are the other topical antibiotics that you'd be thinking? And then I don't know if this means that our clinic is special, which would make my day, but I feel like silver sulfadiazine is something that I have just now had the knee-jerk response of, oh, burn. Silver sulfadiazine. I've never been able to speak quickly enough to say it in a knee-jerk speed, but does that have a role in burns? Is that something I'm applying completely unnecessarily? Or let's talk more about other ointments. What else can we put on these bad boys?
Okay, well, I mean, I guess you can call them bad boys too. It's something I would love to adopt as a nomenclature. silver sulfadiazine, now we say SSD because it's easier to say.
Nice. Best pro of the show.
Yeah, I know that. I'm glad I showed up for that one. Has been around since the 1960s. And silver is a great broad antiseptic agent. And so silver is great when you have a deeper wound. So an appropriate use for silver would be a wound that is of a deeper nature will take longer to heal. And so silver would work very well. Most of the burns that you see in your clinic, though, Justin, at least I hope that that's the case, are more shallow than that. So silver sulfadiazine is not necessary. And there's some literature to suggest that when you put silver next to keratinocytes, it does slow down their their progress. So silver sulfadiazine nowadays is we use on like deeper second degree, but that's still not very frequent, but definitely like the third degree, the eschar, like we mentioned earlier. And those are the surgical burns. We do that to temporize the eschar, delay the onset of invasive infection, and then give us a few days to plan for surgery to replace that skin. If it's large enough. If it's a small wound, yeah, you can let that heal with SSD. But if it's like, let's say, 0.5% or larger, most of us would at least counsel the patient like, hey, you should think about having a skin graft for this.
I see. But so for the more superficial common burns, SSD probably is more harmful than helpful because while you're gaining some of these antibiotic coverage or antiseptic properties, you're delaying some of the healing potentially. Is that?
Yeah, that's right. And it's not, I mean, it's soothing. So people like using it.
Yeah.
That's what they learn in medical school, or like, you know, from their colleagues. But in general, as far as like those of us who are involved in bone care, we rarely use SSD anymore. So if somebody on the phone talking, oh, I want to use SSD and I'll see the patient in a couple of days anyways, it's fine. But in general, the framework that we talked about, like moist wound environment, hydrophobic barrier, and antiseptic based on a depth of the wound, for most applications, you recognize that bacitracin is plenty for what you need.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I don't do that. The other people do the SSD. I do bacitracin. The other people do the silver.
Yeah. No. We get this all the time, and I that's why we made actually YouTube videos for people, because I was having this conversation like all the time, and so in our center,
this is great.
When you call, and then you know our transfer center nurses talk to you about this, and then we use a YouTube video link to reinforce some of this.
Teaching. We'll be able to get those links to put in our show notes, you think?
Yeah, absolutely. One thing I've done in my life where I've gotten no academic recognition, but it's stored on the UW Surgery home for YouTube. And so, you know, that's more useful than any paper I've ever written in my life.
We're all about doing high impact work that provides no academic recognition. That's our motto. Yeah.
Yeah.
Perfect. After speaking with the family, you decide that they should head to the nearest pediatric emergency department for further evaluation. So let's move us into the Cashlack Peds emergency department, which we are also very lucky to have a pediatric burn unit. Javier is estimated to have about burns of 15 to 20% total body surface area. And one of the things that we talked about at the top of the show was the importance of working in a team. And so when I'm in the emergency department on my rotations, I've seen a lot of people show up whenever there's a pediatric burn. I mean, I was wondering if you can talk to us about what kinds of people and what kinds of roles are involved in running a pediatric burn unit.
That's a great question. Yeah, we have spies everywhere in the ED. So as soon as we hear a word of a burn, we just descend upon the ER and try to wrestle the patient from our colleagues. No, I'm just kidding. I think it's, I think we have, one of the things that we do well in the burn community, we have high ownership. Our partnership with the pediatrician is key. And so, yeah, I mean, when you have a burn that's 15, 20%, there's no way that child's going to go home. So we know that the sooner we look at that patient together, you, me, and the ED doc, I think we can make a plan together. That patient that has a burn that large will need a formal resuscitation, will need to stay in a hospital. I've never successfully managed a burn at about that size patient. It's not wise to do. And so that's a patient that needs admission. As a matter of fact, at our center, we use 15% as a criteria for a child to go to the ICU because you do need to be resuscitated in a monitored environment with vital signs and urine output every hour. And so our acute care ward doesn't do that. And so we've actually put the child in ICU, even though the injury is not like massive, but it's still significant enough to need a formal resuscitation. So we want to expedite all that. And so one of our goals, Crystal, is that to collaborate with the ER and the pediatrician to get that child into a monitoring environment as quickly as possible. What makes a burn team? That's a great question. The burn team is a interdisciplinary group of medical providers. So in terms of our center is the PICU docs working together with us for a child like this. And we're general surgeons, some are plastic surgeons. And then we have all allied specialties working together. So nursing is a huge component because they're the strongest advocates. Therapy for range of motion in the extremities affected, but also psychological recovery. So we have a psychologist on our team who's trained in pediatric psychology, and so many other therapists in all disciplines to help you, a pediatric dietitian, a pharmacist. And so it's a team of like 30, 40 people thinking about you from the start in order to optimize your recovery.
I love it. And you mentioned, you know, the need for ICU at the 15 or 20% at this level. Can you go through, what are we worried about in a patient that has this level of burns? Is it hydration? Is it infection? Is it scarring? What are the things that where the higher volume or surface area of a burn starts causing complications?
Well, all the things you mentioned are true, Justin. So, but dehydration is the first thing. And so a burn wound will have a huge capillary leak at the site, which also will cause a lowering of plasma protein outside of that site and a promotion of edema. And so if you don't have enough intravascular volume, you will do poorly. Now, many kids, let's say it's a scar, there's no airway issues, they can do some of the resuscitation even by mouth. And so that's what we often tell people on transport, if it's like, you know, 10-15% seems to be a reasonable cutoff. But a more formal resuscitation where you actually have a Foley in place, make sure that the urine output is adequate and the vital signs are adequate and the child is maintaining, doesn't look like, you know, they're listless and things like that, are all very important things in the next 24 hours. As you put ointments on to delay the onset of infection will come in the next 3 or 4 or 5 days if the wound is not optimally cared for. And then the scarring is a something that you worry about for weeks, depending on the depth of the injury and what was needed to care for it. And so all these concerns are true. And that's why we exist as a specialized team to address all these issues together. The psychological recovery, which I alluded to, is major. You know, sometimes you can be very well healed from a physical standpoint, but have a lot of issues in your recovery and your reintegration. So our child life therapists, our psychologists are all important team members.
And so for our patient with 15 to 20%, if they're rolling into the ED, and let's say we're either a team member or, you know, the first line resident seeing this patient, we're going to work on hydration, PO if that seems reasonable, but we have low threshold for IV fluids and Foley to monitor them. What are other things we're doing for burn care management?
Well, I think with a need for wound care, then naturally comes the need to treat pain. Because sometimes some burns, like, they may look okay, but as soon as you think about doing wound care for them, pain and sedation are major issues. And so you want to... now my dog's the one acting up, so I'm not happy.
It's all right.
I'm not sure that you were able to hear me okay, but I think... let me repeat. So... Justin, so you bring up an important point. As with wound care, the issue of pain and sedation, at least for procedural pain and sedation, becomes a major issue. And so especially for a wound that large, you need to have a plan together. This is why our PICU colleagues come in, pediatric anesthesiologists come in, to kind of like make sure the first wound care goes well and that we can have an appropriate assessment of the extent of injury and the depth of injury. Sometimes the skin looks like it could be okay on an arm, but then when you like do a good washcloth and wipe it, the wound is a lot more extensive than what you thought it was. So an injury that looks like 15% could wind up being easily 25%. And another plug I'll put in is that especially on people of skin color that you are not used to assessing, you can be easily fooled. So on very light skinned people, on very darker skinned people, I've had our trainees being very... prone to under triaging these patients, you know? And so then a good washcloth, and then, oh man, you say, oh, like this wound is totally denuded. This burn is much larger. So don't sit in the ER with a 10, 15% burns thinking that's the final TBSA injury. because you need experienced eyes, and then you need a washcloth and a pain and sedation in order to fully assess that child.
What type of sedation are we working with? Is it ketamine? Is it other types of pain management?
Ketamine is a good choice. It has also some pain mitigation component, but we also most of the time will give an opioid in addition to a sedative agents. You know, in a teenager, sometimes all you need is a little fentanyl and Voced. You know, it depends on the age of the child and what their current experience is. I mean, if you have not touched a child and they look like they're about to be very distressed, then you have to kind of really game up, you know? So it all depends. But I think the first wound care is very, very important. However, a child will cry. So sometimes, like, if you have a hand and you want to just do a one washcloth with something, I've seen centers where, like, they're unwilling to do that until, like, they schedule the next day with, like, a experienced provider. I think that's overkill, honestly. You know, you have to provide something that you can treat the child tonight so that the family can, like, be triaged and go home. As opposed to, like, you know, demanding that the child will be under for every wound care experience. So there's a balance there, you know, because I've seen kids 2 or 3 weeks later when they healed in the clinic, and they're like, I want to go get under anesthesia. I want to be asleep for my wound care. I'm like, you healed, you know, like there has to be a balance.
You know, back when I was a resident, I think when we were rotating through the burn unit, I was seeing some use of dexmedetomidine. I don't know. Is this still something that people have been using or trying? It's been a long time since I've been a resident.
But. Yeah, we use a lot of dexmedetomidine. That's why Precedex is used, as you say. But I guess you don't want us to use those names. But yeah, so Dex, in short, is we use that a lot for sedation while under procedural sedation, and also primarily with the ventilator management or weaning. But I think it's not as our first line, at least that I've seen, our pediatric anesthesiologists use as much as, like, you know, propofol or ketamine.
And so for one of these patients with, again, kind of a high volume burn, we're worried about infection. We've talked about maybe this would be an SSD patient, but how are you preventing infection? You know, does someone need to be on prophylactic antibiotics in addition to topical? And if they do have an infection, what are we worried about? What type of infections are most common in burn patients?
So as I said before, the topical is all you need to delay the onset of infection. If the wound looks a lot deeper, meaning there's a chance that gram negative will colonize the wound, and the wound will be slow to heal, SSD would be appropriate. But otherwise, something that covers gram positive, such as bacitracin, is more than appropriate. And then if you put a greasy gauze on top of that together with the ointment, then it locks the wound together. So even in a larger wound, your strategy tends to be the same. Nowadays, we often use a lot of silver-releasing products, and so we put those together with different types of products, including like foam products or other products, whatever we can put the dressings on. It's not as goopy as other things in order to temporize as well. So you'll see us do that in these wounds. And sometimes even more shallow wounds, because it's a good trade-off. If I can put it, let's say you were scalded on your chest, and then I can put it on and then not having to reevaluate that as soon as tomorrow is a big advantage for the patient. So these multi-day dressings, you see those used a lot by us. But the main key is that what did you think the wound was going to look like and how was it going to progress? Remember the dermal blanching we were talking about. So a wound that has dermal blanching, I can put it in a multi-day dressing and leave it on to up to a week. And then you could go home sooner. You can come back and then I could reassess. But a wound that's not blanching and I put a multi-day dressing, I should look at it sooner than a week, because some things may happen to that wound called bone wound progression, where you have to reassess and see how deep the injury is and what's happening to it.
Maybe just to follow up with that too, it sounds like, so a lot of the management is the cleaning, the pain management, the anxiety management, the topical wounds, and then kind of watching and monitoring. What is the next step? Is there surgical debridement, or is really the hospitalization just fluids, cleaning, and pain management?
Yeah, I just realized I didn't answer your last question well. So let me just also add a statement to that. And I apologize for that, because it's a very important point you made. And I should have covered that. systemic antibiotics. You should not use systemic antibiotics. Please, 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 please don't do that. Because if you take that argument to the extreme, so I've seen that because I've traveled to other countries. At first, people say, oh, I want to use Keflex, Bactrim, whatever. That's like what you might use in the United States. And then you have so much antibiotic pressure that like next year, you're going to use a stronger antibiotic. And then the year after, you're going to use even a stronger antibiotic. So I've been to countries now, you guys, where like if somebody has a burn, the first thing they start on is like Piptazo. And then within days, when we admit those patients to the unit locally, the antibiogram profile of the bugs that are on top of these wounds are so nasty that like I could not imagine until I saw the culture results myself. Like things that would only be sensitive to tigecycline, minocycline, or cousins. And so, and that's only like 5-6 days after injury. So the antibiotic pressure, the ecological environment of your unit are huge things. And this is part of why burns in low and middle income countries don't have as much of a chance to survive. I think part of it can be traced back to the overuse of systemic antibiotics. So I don't think we should start that in this country. And I stop antibiotics when people are on antibiotics. There are very few burns, at least in the first couple of days, that are, you know, going to get infected and have a systemic threat.
Beautiful. Very, very helpful. And so maybe building on that, indications for next line of treatment as far as surgical debridement or grafting, are there other, it sounds like we're okay on topical. Well, actually, maybe we can cut back a little bit before going to that. If you don't mind, maybe going a little bit more on the infection. So we're using topical bacitracin to zest and hit most gram positive. If it's a deeper wound, we might use SSD to cover some gram negatives. Obviously, there's still concern for infection. With those by themselves, are there a substantial number of patients who are getting septic, and what are the common pathogens? Or is this something that really with early topical treatment, we have nothing to worry about?
It's very rare if you do good wound cleansing, which is a very important point, and then have that wound well debrided, not having a bunch of slough on it or dead tissue, that a topical antibiotic is sufficient most of the time. Or a multi-day dressing with the caveats, as I mentioned earlier. Look at that wound sooner. If it looks deeper, you can go for several more days if it looks like it's more shallow. So those principles are plenty. Now, a wound of a third degree, remember the surgical burns like I talked about, those you need to discuss with a patient, like whether they would be amenable to having a skin graft as a skin replacement strategy. So debridement is a vague term. So what we mean, debridement in the ER and like early on care, is cleansing. That's what we call it, because cleansing is much more clear. That's like a washcloth, some blunt instrument to pick off loose tissue. When we talk about debridement in terms of surgery, we talk about tangential excision, meaning you're under anesthesia of some type, or at least your limb is under anesthesia because you have a catheter, let's say. And then we would take a tangential knife, and then we move the top layer by layer until we get down to a viable wound base. And then we decide on that, how to replace that, whether we do it in one stage, multiple stages or not. So I think debridement is like a tough term. I would recommend that we use the word cleansing, because cleansing, when they say you call an ER, say, hey, can you cleanse that wound with a washcloth? That seems like, hey, it's very doable. But when you say debridement, can you debrid that blister? It sounds like, oh my God, you want me to do what? So I think cleansing is for the outside the OR, and then surgical debridement, which is really tangential excision, is what I think what you're referring to next, Crystal, in terms of like us providing a skin replacement to something that was not going to heal in a reasonable amount of time. In general, when you have a wound that heals in 3 weeks or more, the chance of scarring is 75%. Mm. So the trade-off is now you have to let me borrow a piece of skin from you in another location in order to transplant that to that location. And you get a more expected result, I guess, from a skin graft is the best way to say it. Reliable result, reproducible result. Whereas if I let you scar your own on your forearm after you heal for 3.5 weeks, 4 weeks, your chance of scarring are much higher. The chance of scarring also has to do a lot with your genetics. So for people who have more pigments, just as myself, such as you, Crystal, our chance is higher than people who have more fair skin. But beyond that, we don't understand it very well. You know, Caucasian people with red hair tend to scar very bad. So one of my mentors you know, and we live in Seattle. He's like, you know, you always think about, you know, like Asian American, African Americans, but be very aware of the redhead from Ballard. And because in Ballard in Seattle is we have a big Norwegian population. So it's like, you know, we have a very limited understanding of the genetics of scarring, but we know that time to healing is a very important component. So if I can get you to heal a little bit faster, and you have a more reproducible expected results from a skin graft.
Maybe can I ask a clarifying question? When you say reproducible or expected, is that to say that there is some medical benefit in it, or is a skin graft completely cosmetic?
On average, it gives you more to work with, especially Justin, like imagine across your wrist, right? You heal and you kind of shrunk in, and now you have a hard time moving your wrist because your skin is so tight right here. So every time you want to move it, it hinders you. Imagine right over your knuckle on your hand. And so then it's like really tight. And let's say you are a field laborer, or like for me, like as a surgeon, like I would want to be able to have more to work with, and on average, less scarring compared to the spontaneous healing, which is what we're talking about with topicals. So it's not like surgery doesn't completely prevent scarring. You do get incur some scarring with surgery, but on average, it's less as you're more functional and you get to be back to yourself, to your prior job a little bit faster in most cases. So you also have to think about like where the thing is. Let's say it's right about your belt line. Well, it depends. Men and women wear our belt lines a little bit differently. But like, let's say you're like an electrical worker wearing your belt line. You know, I know this is a PEDS podcast, so hopefully that's not as relevant. But it is important, you know, to see what activities are important to you and how it affects your function later on.
And I think with that conversation, and what I'm really hearing is that there's a lot of conversation that is happening with families and patients about kind of what expected management looks like. You know, they've had this, you know, terrible burn that has led them to being hospitalized for several days. They're thinking about whether or not they, you know, need different levels of medical intervention during their time. But, you know, families are hopeful about getting home. And so what is the idea around discharge criteria, and what is the recommended follow-up that you might give our patient Javier or any family once they've kind of experienced this burn? What does life look like after the hospital, and how you decide when they're ready for that moment?
So I'm going to try to unpack a little bit. One is because of like we needed a big team to take care of you, we understand that the care is complex. If it were easier to take care of you, we wouldn't need as big of a team. That's the other thing to think about. Because if we had like better results with burns, maybe we don't need as much of like you working with a therapist to make sure your wrist works fine for like weeks after when you discharge and home. If your appearance was the best after you've had your facial burns, then we won't need to talk about scar rehabilitation, laser therapy, resurfacing, scar releases, and makeup. And so this is part of like, you know, why we have a big team, is because I think care could be better. This is part of why I got into this, is because, you know, when I was choosing a field in medicine, I wanted to like make a contribution to like care to be better, you know? So that's like, you know, my soapbox on that. But in terms of like how long you have to be in a hospital, the way we view this is that if you're already in a hospital, on average in the United States, a burn for every percent you have burn, you stay there for a day in a hospital. So for like a 15% burn, you may be there for up to 2 weeks. Now, if you have a shallow burn, and I can put you in a multi-day dressing, your pain management is okay, you have a place to go, you have caregivers who care about you, and they make sure that you eat and drink and don't get dehydrated, and you're able to come back to clinic, then we can discharge you a little sooner, you know? So those are our criteria that we use to have you go home, is that you're only here because we can do something for you that you cannot do for yourself. But otherwise, you can be home. But you can be here also because you need surgery, so that if your burn is a lot, going from second to third degree now, then we have to find a day to do surgery. And then you need to recover from surgery. And when we borrow the skin of the same size on your thigh, for example, as a donor site, in order to transplant it to your forearm that was not going to heal, well, the thigh also needs to kind of do well, because thigh, where we borrow the skin, is also going to hurt. And so we have to manage that pain and have that subside in order for you to be able to succeed at home. So for those reasons, on average, I find that like if you do surgery on a large enough area, you tend to be in a hospital for like a week afterwards in order to have everything go okay. Only on small areas, I would say like 1 or 2%. So meaning like two hands with including the fingers. So beyond this area burn, we tend to have to keep you just for a few days. But when you get to like one, two, or like, you know, some people are very motivated to leave, they can leave right away. And now we have neuro dressings. Sometimes negative pressure wound therapy can help us in order for you to be able to go home. But on average, in the United States, for 80% of your burns that you have, you stay here for a day in the hospital. So that's helpful. And your recovery, which is, I think, you're about your fifth question. The recovery, it depends. Like if you have like a more shallow burn, you can look like great and feel great and function great and go back to being a graduating chief resident in weeks. But if you have a burn that needed surgery, especially it's across the joint, and we have you, you know, meet with our therapist, you learn everything you do a lot of exercise at home, it becomes almost like a full-time job for you to like make sure that that joint works the best thing you can. So you function in the best way you can, but you're going to have some potential threat for limitation, even if you're not adhering as best to the therapeutic recommendations. And that's very, very tough. You know, we're asking people things that we may not be the best at hearing ourselves. You know, if I have to be completely honest with you. And so am I, like, if you ask me to wear a collar 23 hours a day, am I going to do that? No, I like to sleep on the side. You know, a collar is not going to be most comfortable. So some of the things, because when your skin heals and shrinks in, it's tough on your recovery. And now you add a layer to that in a child, like where they may not be able to comprehend and rationalize on how and why this has to be done for the better outcome that you get 6 months, a year from now, is even tougher. And so I've seen parents being quite a bit distressed and distraught about this process, you know. I do some reconstruction work with some of these kids who are like, you know, let's say you had a finger under a treadmill a year ago, and now, you know, it still tends to shrink. You know, I become essentially your surrogate primary care provider, because working on that finger, splinting it, lasering it, it becomes a multi-year effort. So I've had kids where like I've taken care of for like 10 years, you know. In this process. So that's both gratifying but also very, very challenging.
You've talked about some of the long-term care you've had with some of these patients, and you've obviously been doing burn care for a very long time. Looking into the future, knowing about things that are coming down, you know, research is being done, what are some like exciting things that are happening in the field, technological advances that you see happening in burn recovery and in this area?
Well, the crux of everything I've told you before, Chris, is that the reason why I've had to take care of a child for 10 years, for example, is that the skin replacement strategies that we have are not adequate. And so then when you get a skin graft, or when you get like a replacement, it doesn't grow with you like the rest of your skin. It tends to shrink, things like that. So some of the more exciting things are like newer strategies to help replace skin, because you want to replace like with like. And you want to wish to have skin like, you know, and this is what I'm going to, you know, show you just real quickly. Like if you're going to pinch your skin on the back of your hand and it totally deforms, but then when you let go, it goes back to perfect. Well, that's a function of your dermis. That's just like such a perfect design, because that extra laxity allows you to kind of totally make a fist and not have any restriction. A skin graft doesn't do that. A skin graft is like this tight replacement, but it's totally inadequate. And so we need to do better in order to replace this. Our dermal templates of skin substitutes are getting better. We also have the advent of spray skin now that we do to help reduce some of the appearance of meshing. So we do a few things in order to reduce the number of days you have to be in a hospital. We find that having to stay in a hospital for every day that you have a burn, so you have a 60% burn, you're in a hospital for 2 months. We find that to be very, very long, you know? So we're doing all that to improve our outcomes. But it's still, I would say, like, you know, let's say you've had like surgery for other things, you know, you may wake up and then you may have like a few little incisions or sometimes even some port sites, you know. And so it's almost impossible when you look at somebody's skin nowadays, sometimes what kind of surgery they've had. But when they've had a burn, you can totally tell that they've had a burn, you know. And that's, you know, I wish that, you know, that would be different 50 years from now. And I think there's some people working on better skin replacement at this point, but we know we're close to like what I would call maturity in our field. Like, you know, one day you have a burn that's severe, and then we replace your skin of the same color type that you have, the same Fitzpatrick color type. And then that would be pliable. And that, you know, when you come across a neighbor on you on the bus or whatever, they wouldn't be able to look at you and say, this person has had a burn. That would be the goal. And you see how, like, and this is another soapbox I have, like, you know, you see how in society, like, including in the media, like, people use burns as a way to kind of, like, see that something bad has happened to you, you know? You look at, like, the major characters in, like, movies, shows, and stuff like that. A burn, especially on the face, is a major thing. Like, it's a trope to indicate that, you know, this person is scarred. Something bad has happened. And so I wish it were different, but you know, the interface between burn and how our society functions and the desire to be perfect, is tough.
I think that's such a really important reflection as we're taking care of young people who are starting to develop with their idea of self and senses of how do we help support people after burns. And I know that I've learned a lot through this entire episode. So thank you so much for being a fantastic guest. But before we sign off, I just wanted to know if there are any main take-home points that you had for the show, things that you're like, yes, the pediatricians need to know these points.
Well, first, the pediatricians take care of way more burns than we do as far as specialists. And so deciding on which ones you can manage and which ones need us to take a second look or even hospitalize is a major thing. But I would invite you as pediatricians to invest as much time as you have in order to see these common injuries, because you do see a lot of them. And that's something that's going to benefit your patients and you through your career. The next concept is a burn wound progression, a wound that looks like could be fine, but then if it's not blanching, be very wary about those wounds because they can surprise you in a bad way and be a lot worse. And the third, which is what we didn't discuss as much, is like if the injury pattern does not fit the story, then think twice and maybe get a second opinion because sometimes injuries are not always accidental. So-called, and you know, the injuries sometimes can be committed by others who have very poor judgment or bad intention. So that does happen. And then finally, the sequela of burns is what you allowed me to talk about, Crystal, is huge, you know, and I can go on a whole day about that because it's what, you know, gets me up in the morning about trying to do a better job.
This is so helpful. I think we've talked about a lot of really wonderful topics. I appreciate also adding something that I think we were all thinking for a while and meant to include is assessing for non-accidental trauma as burns can be a presenting symptom. But this has been wonderful. I feel more comfortable about taking care of burns in the primary care and urgent care setting. I know now Chris is going to be better about all the silver, the SSD that he was prescribing unnecessarily. And some great understanding of kind of the burn team. This has been so wonderful. We have a big listener base. Is there anything that you'd like to plug or anything, whether it's YouTube videos or content that you think our listeners should check out?
Yeah, I'm happy to share the link to our YouTube videos. Thank you for having me. One thing we didn't talk about is the pediatric airway. That's something that, like, you know, I'm sure you're going to cover that in other episodes and other venues, but just remember the child with a pediatric burn from a house fire, something like that. If you're not humble about the airway, something's wrong with you. So be very mindful of those. And then I think this is a continuous learning. I'm so glad to be part of this. So, you know, this podcast will hopefully help people get a little bit more familiar with this topic.
Thank you again so much for your time, for your expertise, your generosity. I think this is great. I think our listeners are going to love it. So thanks for joining us today.
This has been another episode of the Cribsiders.
Because it's for the kids.
Get show notes and sign up for our weekly Knowledge Food Formula Feeds newsletter on our website, thecribsiders.com.
We're committed to providing you with high-value practice-changing knowledge, and to do that, we need your feedback, so please subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts, or contact us at thecribsiders@gmail.com. A special thanks to our wonderful producer for this episode, Dr. Crystal Nora, our showrunner, Dr. Sam Mazur, and our wonderful social media team on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. I've been Justin Lee Burke.
I'm Crystal Kamtochukwu Nora.
And this has been Chris the Chew Manchu. Thank you, and good night. And for those who made it all the way to the end, here's that treat you've always been waiting for, the poem that's written by AI. In the care of healer's tread, a tale unfolds of gentle deed. For skin so tender, harmed by flame, in children's cries, their pain we name. When the fire's touch, a harsh caress, leaves a mark, a painful stress, the healers come with skill and grace, in their hands a healing embrace. Cooling waters first to aid, quench the fire, calm the braid. Gentle creams and dressing kind shield the wound, peace to find. In whispered rooms, surgeons weave a tapestry of skin they leave. With grafts and care, the flesh to mend, a journey long toward heal and bend. Pain, a shadow, ever near, is ease with medicines clear. With tender words and soft embrace, the young ones find safer place. Rehab's dance, a step by step, guides little feet where challenges slept. Each movement a victory small, in life's grand play, they stand tall. Thus, in this verse of care and love, a tribute to those who work above. In treating burns, their heart and art bring healing's gift, a life's new start. See you guys.